right. Thank you so much for having me. I will cast a light on the question of working with animals from a different perspective. First of all, I look at it from a legal and ethical perspective. And what I want to focus on really is the view of perceiving animals as laborers themselves. So in both ethical, sociological, political, and legal writings, there's a trend right now to perceive or talk about animals as laborers. And we consider that there are certain aspects of the debate that are problematic, both in terms of contrasting it to humans, but also in terms of creating a too big of a divide between humans and animals. So I'm sure many of you are well aware of this. Usually in animal law, ethics, there's a huge divide, or the debate is positioned as there being a huge divide between people who advocate for welfare reforms, so keeping animals as property in our legal field, but then improving the conditions step by step. And opposed to that are basically the abolitionists who say that animals should have rights, but they also have a claim to personhood, so they shouldn't be property anymore. And now, from a legal and ethical perspective, this debate is really much at an impasse, to the extent that the debate is not moving on. And animal labor is basically positioned as a promise to overcome that impasse. So we have insights, for example, from history, according to which Hubal, for example, says that animals are part of a neglected working class. We've also got perspectives from sociology. So Nosk and Stewart are among the ones who, for example, looked at cows being alienated from their product, from their co-workers, but also from production processes. And Porter and Coulter are among the ones who basically look at whether animals themselves perceive what they do as labor. In relation to that, we've also got demands by philosophy and political theory, who basically are scholars who say, well, animals have, based on justice concern, a claim to rights. And now, the promise of animal labor basically is, first of all, it's a very neglected lens, so it's something that hasn't really been examined so far. Animal labor captures the so-called political, but also the personal or moral. So while moral ethics is criticized for having been focused too much on the moral, animal labor captures both of these dimensions. And the common narrative, of course, is to perceive animals as some sort of agents when they're doing labor, as opposed to just them being property and them being a product, or, you know, just an object within the production systems. And of course, animal labor also allows us to position the animal in an interspecies community. So when we look at the discourse in animal labor, most of the discourse is focused on certain types of animals. So for instance, sports animals are pretty much recognized to do animal labor. Draft animals are recognized. There's a whole lot of work going on with regard to care animals, be it assisted therapy, guide work, but also rescue work from fire, earthquakes, avalanches. There's police and military work going on, even detecting mines, catching fugitives, transporting, but also retrieve work, food and diseases that are being detected on airports, for example, as well as herding. Now, what is neglected most of the time, however, is farm animals. And from an ethical and political perspective, it is much more pressing to deal with that aspect, simply because if one looks at the numbers, the FAO states that in 2014, 65 billion farm animals worked. So just from a numbers perspective, there are strong reasons to look at whether farm animals do provide work as well, and to what extent the lens of labor is a useful lens to think about our relations with animals. Now, the work farm animals do looks very different from the work that draft or police dogs do. In this respect, Choslin Porcher is among the best or most well-known scholars to have examined whether farm animals do in fact labor. Porcher vehemently rejects current treatments of animals in intensified production. In her book, she devotes considerable time into defending animal breeders and arguing that animals used in small-scale farms are farm animals and are laborers, in fact. What she doesn't examine, however, is whether animals... So three main problems, I think, that are, you know, neglected by Porcher in her analysis of farm animals. First of all, it's the fact that animals cannot influence the work relationship and are still part of this so-called production processes. Animals as laborers are also killed at the end of the labor process. And so the question comes up, what about consent? Can we reasonably speak of an animal as an animal laborer if the animal doesn't have a chance to consent to the working conditions? So what I will briefly look at with you today, what we will briefly look at today is who is a worker. There are different disciplinary perspectives that we can take here, a legal, sociological, political one. We will import some insights from contractarianism, and then we will look at substantive and procedural labor rights for animals. So the question is, how can we? Is there a successful way of bridging or of finding a bridge from production to labor processes? So who is a worker? I basically look at this question from a legal perspective because it's still very much debated in law. Labor still is a site of justice and injustice, also for humans. The question of who is a laborer is often, you know, answers basically who gets access to the rights that are implicated with the labor rights concept. So the most common test, and that's basically found across all states, is the one that's also found in the common law test. So there are three criteria that are usually used. One is personal service, so one just really exercises the service him or herself without having a commissioned person in between. And that's basically the case with animals. Then there is the criterion of dependency, so economic dependency versus subordination. There's a huge debate in law going on with respect to that. Economic dependency basically means you're dependent on one employer, and subordination captures more the political dimension, so not being able to influence the labor relationship. Whatever criterion we take here, when it comes to farm animals as laborers, we find that dependency is present. Now, the third criterion that is usually used is either a contractual relationship or a mutuality of obligations in law, and here it's still very much debated. So contractual relationships, the UK, for instance, is a harsh defender of the view that contracts have to be present in the physical sense, and that even if you determine someone as an independent contractor in their labour contract, though it doesn't conform reality, that's still going to be valid. So basically that opens up a possibility for sham corporations and for corporations to just claim those are not our workers, so we don't have to provide pensions and disability pensions, retirement, etc. So those are just independent contractors. So the focus on very formal aspect of the contractual relationship leads to alienating employees. And now with regard to animals, the basic question is, of course, do animals even have the capacities that are needed to enter contractual relationships? Most of the people would, of course, deny that this is possible. Now, an alternative view, I'll come back to the contractual relationship and agency. An alternative view is to look at mutuality of obligations, and that's very common in the human labor case. So one doesn't actually need consent to establish labor relationships, but if there are obligations that are mutually exchanged, then there is a labor relationship. And now, of course, one could say, well, animals have been working for us for many centuries, particularly since the industrialization. Animals have considerably contributed to our society and to our well-being, so there's a mutual exchange of obligations. Now, I think this is too superficial, and law comes to its limits at this point. So this is why I basically look at philosophical debates to see whether we can import these insights to law. I basically look at Rawlsian contractarianism. Contractarianism, especially Rawls' position, is the most accepted one in philosophy. So Rawls relies on two main concepts. One is the original position, and the other is the veil of ignorance. And the original, it basically means, in order to arrive at the most just principles that ought to govern a society, people in some sort of imaginary pre-contract or pre-political state agree to principles where they do not know their conceptions of the good. So they do not know their strength, their knowledge, their intelligence, or their characters. Because such qualities make it impossible to basically choose a position afterwards that will benefit you. You will choose a position that is beneficial to most of all, whom their well-being matters personally. Now, Rawls says that only moral persons can be participants in the original position. Now, that poses a particular problem because he doesn't fully answer that question. He says moral personhood is sufficient to be a participant in the original position and be entitled to equal justice. Now, if it's just sufficient, that means it also opens up the gate to including moral patience among the recipients of justice. That would, of course, also include animals. If it's necessary, on the other hand, this would also mean that certain people who are, for instance, who lack moral agency due to age or illness do not get access to equal justice claims. And now this poses a particular problem, and one which hasn't been solved by Rawls. Rawls himself leaves this question open. Philosophers like Carruthers have gone great lengths to help Rawls at this instance, and they basically said, well, we've got to keep in humans but still exclude animals because this adds to our long-term community stability. Now, of course, most of the philosophers disagree with that. They say, I'm sorry, it's a bit blurred. They basically say, well, that's like having different criteria for intraspecies community compared to extra-species communities. And Rawls in this regard says, well, the property of being a human being is, again, something over which we have no choice. The property is, in Rawls' sense, morally arbitrary as a property of belonging to a given race or class or gender. So what are we doing with Rawls at this instance? Because we're at an impasse again. So we got three options broadly. First is we return to Hobbesian contractarianism. Rawls himself developed a theory that would have advanced Hobbesian contractarianism because Hobbes basically relies on mutuality of obligations. But that also means if we have periodical or endless incapability of providing advantages due to illness, age, etc., then we're basically excluded from the contract and excluded from justice claims. And the other particular downside of Hobbesian contractarianism is that it lacks impartiality, so contractors are viewed as self-directed agents. And that basically would mean, we cannot take on to moral progress anymore. And now the second option would be to just bite the bullet and go with strict Rawlsian contractarianism. That again means, well, some humans will be excluded, and that runs counter to moral progress of our society. And now one point I want to raise at this instance really is that, the argument that is being made with the slippery slope and the marginal case argument that certain humans will sometimes or, due to illness, be in a state where they lack moral agency, there's really a strand in philosophy that starts to question our rationality at large or the criteria that are being used to make the claim for full rationality and decision-making in the human case. So Zaluski, for example, shows, well, what usually is said that we humans have in order to be contractors of the initial position is free will, rationality, and self-consciousness. But when we look at free will, for example, Liebert and Wegner have shown that brain activity precedes conscious decision-making. When it comes to rationality, the work of Kahneman, for example, shows that we're subject to a vast number of heuristics, cognitive biases. We do intuitional decision-making as opposed to rational decision-making. And with regard to self-consciousness, beyond the practical, so beyond functioning on a practical level, we really engage in so many self-deceptive practices. So the question is, how rational are we ourselves? And so instead of focusing on rationality and moral agency, scholars have come up with the interest-based account of Rawlsian contractarianism. So they argue, well, the framers of the contract do not have to be the same people as the recipients of justice. One could be a framer of contract, but still, through the veil of ignorance, basically injure against becoming an animal after the contract was concluded, right? So that combines the advantages of Rawlsian contractarianism with strict impartiality. Because the occupants of the original position would, of course, care about what is happening to them if they were a sentient being capable of suffering, they will injure against that by including their claims within the contract of equal justice. So if we import these insights into law, this basically means we have the criterion of personal service, the criterion of dependency, and the criterion of selfhood. That means whenever we encounter such vulnerable selves, whenever we encounter someone home, they need protection through the principle of inviolability, which provides a protective shield of basic rights around every individual. Now, importantly, you may have noticed that we do not have consent in this definition of labor. So one would think, you know, a labor relationship should have to be consented to by the animals. Importantly, we do not have this criterion because it means we also recognize that forced labor is a part of labor. This leads to the recognition of what animals do as labor, even if it's forced. It prevents a legal vacuum because otherwise, once labor law isn't available to advance justice for animals anymore, there's not much we can do. Whereas in the human case, we've got human rights, we've got constitutional protections, etc. So, animals should therefore have access to substantive labor rights, and one could ask again, so why rights even in the first instance, protections should be enough? Well, according, first of all, this would be Kantianism for humans and utilitarianism for animals, but that would violate Rawls' difference principle, because Rawls says the difference principle determines that inequality is justifiable if and only if it improves the status of the least well-off. Now, scholars argue that animals should therefore have access to a host of substantive labor rights. I'm not going to go into detail with regard to this, but just going to add a few more words with regard to procedural labor rights that animals should have access to. And that's exactly where consent comes into play. So there are growing calls for animals' political inclusion in political decision-making processes because the animal industrial complex has become a primary instance to show that problems are systemic. There are also immense power relationships going on in animal agricultural industry. We can see that with regard to ag-gag laws, veggie libel laws, and agricultural exceptionalism. I will not go into detail with this right now, but you can ask me afterwards if there are questions here. So Donaldson and Kimlicka, for example, say that, well, because of this claim to political inclusion, animals have rights to citizenship, denizenship, and sovereignty. This basically means having rights with relationships, and that is the middle position that we have between welfarism and abolitionism. And particularly, animals should have a right to participation through their political agency. This is especially useful with labor law because labor law is a site of justice and injustice, and there are huge power symmetries going on in labor law. Animal law is also a form of hidden work. So Chasen Ribal has in this respect said, since the 17th century, a great many animals have been put to work. They have produced large monetary profits. They have received little to no compensation or recognition of their efforts. The farms, factories, roads, forests, and mines have been the sites of production. Here they have manufactured hair, milk, flesh, and power for the farm, factory, and mine owners. And here they are unwaged. So when we look at labor law, basically labor law is a site of vulnerability, of a site of also advancing from vulnerability to empowering individuals. And so consent, autonomy, and free decision-making are axiomatic pillars to move from unfree labor to free labor. I unfortunately do not have time to go into detail with regard to this, but there are two main ways of including animals in the political decision-making process. And that is, first of all, through representation. There are certain downsides of this concept right now. We already have certain types of representation of animals in political processes right now, but there's institutional and personal dependence, and there's a systematic underrepresentation of animals in these bodies. So what it should be guided by is the principle of beneficence, so to take decisions in the best interests of animals. And there's also increasingly calls for direct participation of animals in political processes. This could be done by assent, concepts of dissent, but also through dependent agencies or an interpreter. That basically means that there's a trustee relationship between an animal and a trustee who imports these insights into decisional processes. And because animals should therefore have, even if they don't have the ability to consent, they should have a right to assent or dissent to animal labor. And this will ensure that they will become autonomous decision makers in labor relationships. Thank you so much.